My name's Nastasia Swift, and this is how I create.
Welcome to This Is How We Create, a show that digs deeper into the creative life of contemporary artists of color. Discover what feeds their creativity and how they've found or are finding their artistic voice. Through these intimate and candid conversations, you'll gain insights into the lives of creative professionals of color that are hard to find anywhere else.
Martine Severin here. Welcome back to the show. What strong beliefs do you hold dear? What convictions do you have towards how you should live your life and how to approach your craft, your work, and your art? It's certainly a tender thing to have the courage of your convictions and to know when to bend the rules to invent something truly novel. For me, I love rules, mainly so that I can learn the rules to whatever genre I'm studying so that I can break those rules in an attempt to create something new and something fresh. In today's episode, Nastasia Swift talks to us about her journey to becoming a fiber artist. She'll share with us how her art helps her to understand Black girlhood in the U.S. Nastasia's work will surprise you and will delight you. And mostly, her approach to her work may give you some perspectives in your life. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back to This Is How We Create. My name is Martine Severin, and I am so excited to welcome Nastasia Swift to the podcast. Nastasia is a sculptural fiber artist who is redefining her use of portraiture through wool to create work that speaks to spirituality, history, and place in relation to the body. Nastasia was recently invited to Penland School of Crafts Winter Residency as a Distinguished Fellow. She is the recipient of a 2022-23 VMFA Fellowship, the 2021 Dr. Doris Derby Award, the Art Matters 2021 Artist to Artist Award, the Black Box Press Foundation 2021 Art as an Activism Grant, and the 2020 Virginia Commission of the Arts Fellowship. My goodness. Whew. And her work has been acquired into the Grace Linton Battam Memorial Fund for the Arts Collection, as well as Quirk Hotel in Charlottesville. Nastasia Swift is currently living and working in Virginia, and I am so excited to welcome her to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nastasia, I'm so excited to have you. As I said, I discovered your work quite by accident, and I have to say, like, my mouth dropped. I was like, who is this woman? How is she creating this work? And it just seemed so singular and novel and not quite work that I had seen before. So I'm really pleased to be able to chat with you, to quell my curiosity by asking you some questions about your practice. So first, one of the things that I read about you is that you originally wanted to paint and you fell in love with fiber arts quite accidentally. Can you tell me about what you were interested in as a child?
I've grown up making and drawing, and a lot of that has to do with my mother. She has this high school portfolio of charcoal drawings of people and her classroom. She liked drawing buildings and houses. So, like, growing up, I spent a lot of time looking through that portfolio with her. And I think it just, like, sparked. I mean, kids love drawing on the wall and we love doodling, but I think, like, seeing these drawings kept away in a portfolio, there was like this understanding of like, these are valuable, these are special, and there's something about these drawings that are important to my mother. And I wanted to do something similar. Like, I wanted to make drawings that were important to me. So I've always been a figurative artist. I think the medium has transitioned over the years. My background was in painting. That was kind of what I fell in love with in high school. Especially oil painting. So when I got to undergrad, painting and printmaking was my major. And I just knew that I was going to be doing oil paintings of people. I fell into fiber, which I love that that's how you put it. I don't know if that's how I've worded it before, but I like the idea that I fell into it. When I had to take a like short-term project class as a freshman at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, and I wanted to do jewelry as a project class, and it was full. So my advisor at the time was like, "Well, there's this fiber course that's open. You should think about taking it." And I was like, "Well, that's not what I want to do here." And I ended up taking the class, and I loved it. There was something about manipulating these materials that I'm already familiar with. Like, fabric isn't foreign because we wear fabric. What was foreign was using fabric and fiber and a form of storytelling in a way that I hadn't done before. I was like, oh, this is not, we're not making garments, which I think still lend, like, garments and fashion in that sense still lends itself to storytelling, but like, I understand it in that way. Using fabric to create a sculpture, it was like, what? How does one do that? And I remember after that course, I was like, I want a minor in craft and material studies. And I knew I wanted a focus in fiber. I got into felting, I think a couple years after that decision, just in like an intro to 3D fiber class, and we learned needle felting. And there was something, I think the first thing I made was like this little magenta heart. I've always enjoyed the idea of me working sculpturally. I hadn't really had a chance to do it, and that was really just like me not seeing myself being capable of working in contemporary sculpture, just as a figurative person. Like, I couldn't see my work translating into that genre. But with needle felting, it was like this click. I immediately thought of people, and that was where I started making dolls. Like, thinking back on that, like, 18, 19-year-old girl who was like, I'm not even interested in doing printmaking. All you're getting is painting out of me, and then falling in love with this material. And ever since that class, felting has been, and wool has been, a part of my work. And it's become like the primary process and material for my practice.
I have several questions following that idea of you going in and thinking that you were going to create portraits and be like your mom and create portraits of people, and then suddenly being really interested in fabric and in sculptures. How has your viewpoint or your how has your idea of the world changed? Or did your idea of the world and what you want to communicate through your work change from doing painting to going into fiber?
I'm not sure I would say that my, I think what I will say is that I think I figured out how to tell the stories that I want to tell in the way that I want to tell them. I think that with painting, and that just could coincide with like being a younger artist or a younger person still trying to like figure out their like how their voice kind of becomes a vehicle, or how this work becomes a vehicle for the work that they want to make or the things that they're saying. I think that at that time, I was just speaking very vaguely about the end things I was interested in. Like, I've always been interested in like, in terms of figurative work, specifically Black figures, and even more specifically Black women and Black girls. Like, that's always been an interest in terms of subject matter and story. And I think at that time, I was kind of stuck in like these umbrella terms, like identity and womanhood and Blackness. But like, those feel like such big words now, especially I think what has happened in this trend. I don't know if it's because of the transition in material. Would I be able to, I consider myself a storyteller, and would I be able to tell stories and paint the same way I've kind of figured out now? Or has felting kind of assisted in the ability to tell stories in the way that I am? That's like a question that I would have for myself. Like, does the material help in that? But I think where I've gotten to now is I'm still interested in the same or similar things. I've just kind of tapped into how I'm supposed to narrate these stories, and like, the how do they come out in these physical things that I'm creating. I don't know if that answers your question.
That does answer the question. I guess then my follow-up question is, what have you learned through that process? What kind of stories do you want to tell now?
What I've learned, at least about myself as an artist and working in this way, is I'm really interested in coming up with a story and not sharing all of it. And I think that might have been something that I was trying to figure out before. Like, how do you tell enough? Do I tell it all? Like, what details are important? And I think that I get really excited about dreaming up these happenings or these moments and then seeing a physical work that needs to be created to describe a piece of that moment or to share a piece of that moment. But I don't need for anyone to get the full circle. Mm. I'm just giving them, like, this is the scene of the play that I'm giving you, but you don't get to see the full play. That's still in my head or in my sketchbook. So that's become a really exciting way for me to think about the full story and be just specific enough to paint a picture or to give the energy of that full story without having to give all of it. I think that's, and I don't know, I think there's something about the time it takes me to make work that forces me to sit with it longer, that even gives me the time to think about a full story. Like, I think when I was painting, I was a relatively quick painter. Like, the amount of time I have to spend with a mask or a felted face, it's like I'm spending so much time with this material and these images, especially if I'm working from other images. I'm like, there's just, it feels like it's a longer process. And I've always enjoyed process. So I think that, like, there are little things about the nature of fiber work that become a part of, like, the way I'm choosing to tell these stories.
Because essentially, I loved how you talked about how you like to share just like a frame of the story or scene. As you were chatting, I was like, oh, okay, so this is what I needed to hear, because there's this project I'm working on, and it's about Black and brown women and how we're seen in society. And I have the story in my mind. As a photographer, you're always taught to show the whole story from beginning to end, and show the arc in several photos. And I'm thinking, maybe I don't need to do that. Maybe I could break that rule and just do a slice of that story as it's happening. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. But recently I was talking to a photographer who said the exact same thing. Like you said, the rule of needing to, like, show this full out kind of developed story, and how she had wanted to just, like, no, I want to have this one image that feels like it gives enough of that story. So it's interesting. I'm all for breaking rules. And like, kind of applying, and not just like breaking them for the sake of breaking them. I think I appreciate understanding the way things are supposed to be done, quote unquote, so I can decide how they're supposed to be done for me and what, if anything, I need to pull from that role to apply it to my role.
So the figures that you felt are very distinct. How long did it take you to come up with that representation of that figure?
I think it varies depending on what I'm making, right? So, like, if I'm the first series of dolls that I made, I was just figuring out the material and, like, how I wanted these figures to look. At that time, there wasn't an interest in making faces of people that I knew or trying to force them to be anything. I actually allowed myself to relinquish a lot of control in the making process. And they didn't have, I didn't even really felt sockets. I think I just, like, felt it really deep holes for the illusion of eyes, and their hands were like these little mittens. So it was a lot of, like, suggestive, like, bodily features. And I think that what's always been important to the way that I'm making these figures is the hair and the lips and the nose. And that's not because all Black people have the same size lips or the same size nose or the same size hair, but it's become this like motif in the way that I'm making these images that you see them and there's no question, regardless of the color of the wool, what type of face it's mirroring. You know what I mean? I feel like Black people can see a face. We know that that's a face that's like a part of our tribe. You know what I mean? And I think that's what's happening with these smaller felted pieces. The mask that I make kind of follow a similar pattern, but with a little more detail. And then in the rare occasion that I'm like making a face of an actual person that I know, you know, that kind of changes the rules up a little bit. But I think in general, the distinction between the faces really just happens organically. It's very hard to try to make them look alike. And that relinquishing of control that I mentioned was really me not trying to force them to be anything. So like outside of saying, okay, I'm making a series of faces that are to be understood that these are Black people. The lips shift and they tilt. The nose, like there's just these wonky things that happen because I'm making them so quickly. I welcome that to happen because I think that's where the distinction between all of them happen because it's almost impossible to make them look alike. That's what works on my side to feel like these are their own characters and their own people.
I mean, you're known for your figures, but you also do quilts, or at least tapestries, as you call them. Well, how was that shift for you from doing figures to doing the tapestries and to continue to explore what being a fiber artist is?
Quilting has brought in some like nostalgic energy from painting. There's something about creating these images with like scraps of fabric that remind me of how I was thinking about color and light with my paintings. So I think that brings a part of like an older version of my like of Nastasia the maker the artist into like this new kind of present fold and it's been really exciting to in the like recent months explore what all of these materials that I'm like really excited about like how do they function together and on the surface. And I remember after I did my large quilt last year, I was like, I don't want it to be, these are my quilts and these are my felted pieces. Like, I really wanted to see how they could enter into a plane together. And then even with beading, like I fell in love with beading and it's like seeing the beads with the wool, these materials together just feel like there's like a harmony with them. And it's been an interesting new direction that I didn't anticipate, but sometimes the best things we don't anticipate. They just kind of happen, like me falling, you know, figuring out that I loved wool and fiber. I think it allows me to figure out how I'm interested in seeing these felted pieces continue. And that's been a big interest that it's been the reason why I've gotten into collaboration and performance. And I've always wanted to see the number of ways I can push wool and felting for myself, and like how many different ways can it interact with the new material. So bringing quilting and beading into it is a way of like doing that, but within like the same family material group, if that makes
That makes
sense.
a lot of sense. And I just want to point out that people can buy prints of your work online, on your website. So I think I'm definitely gonna just take a look over there to see what I could get for myself. But
Yeah.
your use of color is so yummy. It's so interesting because when in your earlier work, when at least the ones I've seen, when you were doing the felted figures, you started out with white figures, and now you've been using, I love the blues, and then I love the pinks, and obviously the bead to simulate hair has been really interesting. So I just wanted to chat about your process in terms of figuring out which colors to use, and even to talk about how you end up or getting that lovely ombre effect that you're known for.
So I think what's interesting is that when I was painting, color was always like an exciting and important part of the work that I was making. I remember a high school teacher telling me that, Nastasia, you use all the colors in the paint pack. And I'm like, okay, I think that's just fine. I just loved figuring out how to use every color. And I think that eventually I started like just coming up with palettes for myself and not getting away from that, but just being more intentional about the color that I was using. But my work has always been saturated in color. So then transitioning into working with all white was almost a surprise even for myself. But there was something, the color white was necessary at that time in terms of those particular stories that I was telling. And I think that now that I'm like slowly getting back into color, a lot of the times the color is specific to what's being shared. So like the color pink in Passage when Mama Lets My Braids Fall Down My Back, like that's about the transition between girlhood into like teen years, and that moment where your mom allows you to have certain hairstyles that you couldn't have before because they were too grown, and all of a sudden your braids can be a little bit longer. And I just remember all of the pink barrettes and beads that I had. So that color is like, and those color beads are so specific to my childhood, many childhoods of other women and girls. Like there's something about we see those beads and it's like I remember the container I had with all the different color-coded beads. So pink was necessary for that piece. And then with the blue mask and that work being about water and ancestry, indigo made sense not only as a color, but definitely as a material in terms of that plant and that process and its correlation to the context of Black history in this country. I enjoy when the process and the materials get to speak to the story because then it feels like I'm not forcing one detail to happen in a way that it's not supposed to. And then with the red piece, Your Banks Are Red Honey, where the moon wanders, red made sense for that piece because I was speaking about menstruation and like the female body and that time of the month. So for me, color comes into play when it makes sense with the narration of the work. And I got into natural dyeing a couple years ago before, and even still now, sometimes I'll work with pre-dyed colors. There's something about indigo that feels really important for me to do myself. Like the pink piece, I didn't dye those colors. I had bought an assortment of pinks, but indigo feels like I'm supposed to be the one dipping that wool into that dye bath and figuring out the chemical process to even get the dye bath to be active. Like it has I think it's the same reason why I don't glue my beads to my work. I stitch them. Like I feel like there's this like material lineage that's present in those materials. It's almost like I'm like disobeying some kind of ancestral rule to buy pre-indigo dyed works or to glue my beads to the surface. It's like my hand has to be a part of that work in that particular case. And beads have just been like, honestly, shopping for beads online. I wish I could go to like, I'm sure if I go to different cities, there's probably like really amazing bead stores. But even just shopping for them online and like figuring out the colors and then getting them and it's, ooh, this looks as beautiful, delicious as it did online, and look at the way the light hits this color, and like I know exactly where I want to see that bead and like what I want it to be next to. So bead shopping is a treat. It's, I should consider it to be self-care
Oh my
because that's what
gosh.
it feels
So do you go on Etsy to get your beads?
I'll look everywhere. Etsy's definitely a place, and you know, most of the time I know what kind of color I'm looking for, so I'll Google like matte lavender bead of this size. And I just look at the websites that show that and kind of explore those. There's a couple sites that I've revisited a few times, but it's really anywhere that has the color that I can kind of see in my head. And then, of course, naturally, you see other beads that you weren't thinking of. And it's like, ooh, I was looking for lavender, but this lilac color is really pretty. And then I see this kind of blue that I didn't think blue needed to be here, but it I like what it's doing with these purple beads. It's like this rabbit hole of finding all the beads that exist.
Oh, as you're talking about beads, I just remember being little, and because I grew up in Haiti, we didn't do beads, but we did ribbons. And so you would just have ribbons in your hair. And I remember when we moved to the US, and my mom, she shouldn't be, I hope she's not listening to this. So we would have the ribbons in our hair, and we'd go into school, and all the kids used to make fun of us for having ribbons. I got to a point where I would take out the ribbons and then put them back in when we went home. But it's interesting what some of the things that are markers of our childhood. And I just, as soon as you mentioned the beads, then I just started thinking about what the hair practices we used to do when we were little. So can you tell me how long did it take you to finish passage when Mama lets my braids flow down my back?
I think I worked on that piece maybe for like 4, maybe like 4.5 months. And I always make sure I say, even though it's listed on my site, I did not make those braids myself. There were two hairstylists that were in the same city as me at the time that did those braids and beads for me, which, I mean, it's not only important in terms of like collaboration to say that, but also in terms of the story. Like that piece is talking about, or I guess I should say, like it's illustrating this moment in this young girl's life where like community and family are coming together to celebrate. Because a lot of the work that I've been making in the past couple of years is speaking to like ritual and like spiritual practices and ceremony, and like understanding that through the lens of our contemporary lives and thinking about what if the transition from girlhood to age, I don't know, like 12, 11, 12, or 13, is celebrated through hair, and like what does it look like for the people of this community to come together to celebrate these young girls and to understand how like the essential role stylists play in our life, even if the stylist is your mother or your aunt or your cousin, like the person doing your hair is very important and there's a special intimacy and connection. And thinking about these two local stylists who've come to like adorn this girl for, you know, this transitional period in her life. Aside from the fact that I wasn't going to be able to do those braids as cleanly as they were done, like their presence and talking with them about it and having them come to the studio, it was that full story being played out. And everyone doesn't get to see those stylists in my studio, but their hands being a part of the work, it kind of signifies their support in the story of this like imaginative girl that we see in that pink piece.
Oh, most black women, we know you've sat in between the legs of some woman at some point in your, that's not your a family member, or you've gone to a salon to get your hair braided, and it's hours. The relationship ends up happening while that process is happening is so special. And I remember when I graduated from college, I applied for a grant to do that, and I wanted to spend time going around Boston, where I grew up, different hairstylists, and to document that relationship, and then even go into Senegal to see the place where all of these ideas come from and how West Africa really sets the trends in terms of what we end up getting over here with hair. I didn't get that grant, but I think I might just do it anyway. I've been
You
thinking a lot about hair and how that is really an intrinsic part of ground girlhood for the diaspora.
should.
Well, I'm glad that you've just reminded me of that project that I had. So we've talked a lot about your artistic practice, and so I'd love to turn the conversation to business a bit. Can you tell me what you've learned about setting up the business side of your art practice, if you will. Have
Yeah.
there been some surprises that you weren't expecting?
Well, so it's funny to be honest to say, like, what have you learned? I feel like I'm still learning, and I don't know if there's any artist who's not still learning. I think one of the many things that I've learned is that there's as many templates as we like to think that there are. I feel like it's so specific to each person and to each person's goals. Like, what your idea of a successful artist may be is going to be specific to you and the life that you want to live and the things that you want to achieve. And like, from it's going to be different from me. And I think that was something that I had to learn, because I feel like there's a perception that this is the road to being a successful artist, and if you do all these things, we'll all get to this place. And I think that that's a little flawed, because what is that place? And does everybody want to be at that place? And I think that each of our places looks very different than the other. And I think that's okay. So I think I had to come to terms with, like, defining that for myself. Like, what do I consider to be success, and like, how do I want to get there? I think that in terms of surprises, I feel like getting to know this art industry, I'm like, who came up with these rules and why are we following them? Like, at some point, does anyone say all of this is pretty antiquated? And do we even know the person? Like, was the person who came up with these rules, were they artists themselves, or were they people profiting off of artists? So I think that as I get older and as I continue to work in this field, I've learned a lot of those rules that I don't care for. But and not just for the sake of, like, I want to be a rebel, but like, who is that rule benefiting, and why can't there be a new process or a new set of systems that make a lot more sense for the people who are creating this work? Like, I just feel like artists get the short end of these rules. So I think that, I don't know if surprise is the right way for me to put it, but I think that, like, over the past at least year or two, in terms of working with galleries or being approached by these larger entities or institutions, it's like definitely been some eye openers. And it's like, okay, I need to make sure that, you know, going back to the drawing board of defining how I want this to look for myself, so that way I know what I'm agreeing to and what I'm not willing to agree to. And like, a certain level of confidence of being cool with, like, I've said no to a lot of things, and it's scary to say no when you're trying to be a full-time artist and you have bills and you're like, am I going to turn this down? But I feel like it's been so important to be like, if that's the value that you think that you can place on me, I have to be okay. If I know that that's not the case, walking away from that. I think I've gotten much better at being okay with saying yes to the things that serve what I'm trying to do and that make sense with that overarching goal, or like what I see for myself, and being cool with, as nice as that, however much fee sounds, it's not the smartest move for me.
Did that take you a long time to get to the point where you were okay with standing up? Because I mean, if you just told me that Passage took you 4 months to do, and then some gallery, if they want to have someone collect it, they're going to take however much percent. There was another figurative artist who shared how much the cut is that these galleries take, and I was really shocked.
That piece isn't even for sale, and that's on purpose. It was for sale when I first made it. There was a lot to be learned from that piece being shown and working with that particular gallery. And I think that I've just realized that, I mean, for one, I think let me go back to your original question. So yes, it took a while. What is it, 2022? I think that like last year was like really the year of me, maybe 2020, because I was not checking for all these places trying to like jump out and grab onto Black talent and Black creators in the sake of like Black Lives Matter. I was like, it that no. So I think that was the year of me being very cool with standing up for myself and being very clear and transparent about what I'm willing to do or not willing to do and the expectations that I have for these institutions that are interested in like borrowing my practice for whatever initiative or something that they're doing that's most of the time very short term. And I think that's what a lot of what was seen in 2020. So yeah, it's very new. Before then, I would always talk about saying no, but then, you know, reality hits. And I think a lot of times these larger entities rely on the fact that artists need projects and funding to do the things they want to do. So it's like, cool, I can shortchange them here because I know they need it and they'll say yes. So, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. I don't want to get on this. I could talk about that for a long time. But yeah, it's taken a while. And I think that I'm still learning and growing and figuring out what things, like I just spoke with a lawyer a couple days ago and realizing that like that's an important business move for me to make to protect myself. And I'm sure over the next few years, there will be mistakes that happen and lessons to be learned. I think that's just like the natural way of getting through something.
Well, thank you for sharing that. What's one tool, app, book that has helped you in your work or in the running of your business?
Gosh, I feel weird to say Instagram, but I guess that's a pretty like, I don't know. I guess that makes sense because I mean, I do rely on that app a lot in terms of connecting with people and meeting people and finding out about opportunities. So yeah, I don't think I should be ashamed to say Instagram.
Okay. So yeah. last question, the great Bisa Butler said, someone asked her, so how can we support you as an artist?
I think to continue being engaged in my work in whatever way that makes sense, whether it's keeping up with the work that I'm doing, whether it's purchasing a print, whether it's telling someone else about my work, or if you see an opportunity, I'm always big on like if I see something that applies to someone, I'll send it to them. I think engaging with my work, like I said, in whatever way that makes sense to the person is a good way.
You said exactly what Pisa said. She said, buy my work. That's what she said. How can folks keep in touch with you and keep up with what you've been, all that you do?
So I'm pretty active on that tool that I mentioned, Instagram, if you've heard of it. My Instagram handle is Nastasja Ebony, NastasjaEbony.
Nastasja, thank you so much. I'm just really learned so much in our conversation and I can't wait to listen. Before any podcast episode goes out, I listen to it at least 3 times. So I can't wait to listen to this one again and to share it with everyone, with our audience, with the world.
Of course. Thank you. And thank you for creating a platform that I can come and share these things with. You too are gold in this realm. Thank you.